This is the story of jazz, which has been called the one truly American art form. Scholars and musicians never seem able to agree on an entirely acceptable definition of jazz. And someone like Louis Armstrong or Fats Waller or some other jazz personality is always being quoted as saying that if you have to ask what jazz is, you'll never know. Jazz is essentially a way of playing music as well as a specific kind of music. Listening is probably the best way of getting to understand it. Jazz is the sound of Louis Armstrong, one of its first great artists. Jazz is the blues, all the way from long-forgotten backwoods singers to Ray Charles.
Let me tell you about a girl I know. She is my baby and she lives next door. Every morning before the sun comes up, she brings my coffee in my favorite cup.
It's the big band music of the swing era and the clarinet of Benny Goodman. And it's modern jazz as played by the irrepressible Dizzy Gillespie. Jazz was created by the descendants of the slaves who were brought here from Africa. And jazz rhythms retain the suggestion and spirit of African drum music. Perpetual toil and drabness marked the daily life of the slaves. Music was a form of relief and even of communication, for the slaves were forbidden to speak their native tongues and were denied education in the English language. In the fields, endless hours of back-breaking labor were eased by rhythmic work songs.
If you don't love me, please don't dog me around touching children. Like you dog me around, I know you put me down.
In the church, variations were sung around old hymns, and a new music evolved, the spiritual.
Sure do need him now.
The slaves were totally dependent on their own resources for entertainment. This picture is unrealistic, but it does show some of the instruments that were favored: violins, banjos, and, in the foreground, a crude flute-like pipe. There is more realism in this view of ragged musicians on the road. After the Civil War, increasing numbers of wandering players moved through the towns and cities of the South. Probably not too skillful, and certainly not making much of a living, but paving the way for an important musical form. That form was the blues. The blues was basically a folk music, and it spoke of the chain gang, the broken love, the wish for freedom. The blues probably started as an unaccompanied moan, closely related to the work song. It was often sung, accompanied by banjo or guitar, by country musicians like this one, a surprising number of them blind. Throughout the history of jazz, the blues has been a vital part of both the vocal and instrumental music. During the same period of the late 19th century, a more sophisticated written pre-jazz form was also gaining attention. This was ragtime. By the turn of the century, it had become the most popular music of the day, spreading throughout the country by means of player piano rolls, the immediate predecessors of phonograph records. Some of the best-known examples of this high-spirited, syncopated piano style were found in the work of Scott Joplin, a Midwesterner. That was a bit of Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag, from an early piano roll probably played by the composer himself. Scott Joplin composed a whole series of ragtime hits and even an ambitious, though never performed, opera, Tremonitia. The rhythmic sound of ragtime was also ideally suited for the brass band. The Eureka Brass Band, with a repertoire of rags and marches, was one of the many groups at the core of Negro social life in New Orleans earlier in the century, playing at all important events from holiday parades to funeral processions. New Orleans in the very early 1900s was the big city of the South. It was the magnet that drew the young and those in search of good times. Behind its cosmopolitan exterior, there was an active, gaudy nightlife in saloons and dance halls and honky-tonks. While it is an oversimplification to say that jazz was born in New Orleans, it is true that this was its focal point. And here, in places like Tom Anderson's Cafe, in the bustling Storyville district, it first became apparent that a new music was emerging. This group of young musicians is on the bandstand at Anderson's Cafe. The date is sometime before 1915. But the instruments, drums, trumpet, saxophones, could be a part of almost any jazz band right up to the present. The men who played at night in the cafes often doubled in the daytime marching bands. The trumpeter at Anderson's, for example, is also the trumpet man standing at the rear to the right in this photograph of the Imperial Band, a marching group. Besides the spirituals, blues, and ragtime, there was another important element in the new jazz music, the European musical tradition contributed by the Creoles of New Orleans, some of whom had training in classical music. This was a smoother music, played in settings more sedate than Anderson's Cafe. But here, too, are the familiar brass and stringed instruments, along with the saxophones and clarinets that were a Creole specialty. From its earliest days, jazz has been dominated by memorable and colorful personalities. The first legendary jazz man was cornet player Buddy Bolden. In this dim pre-1900 photograph, he is standing behind the guitar player. The cornet player in the original Superior Orchestra was another especially notable performer, Willie Bunk Johnson. A quarter century later, he was to be the central figure in a revival of early jazz. The cornet, or trumpet, carried the melody and was the most forceful horn in a jazz group. Thus, trumpeters tended to be the most important members of New Orleans bands, and the best were given the complimentary name King. No one questioned that the title was deserved by King Joe Oliver, or by King Freddie Keppard, leader of the original Creole Orchestra. Keppard's was the first group of its kind to leave New Orleans and travel extensively. Gepard was offered the chance to make the first jazz phonograph recordings, but he refused. He was afraid others could too easily steal his musical style. So today, Gepard's name is only dimly remembered. But King Oliver went on to become a lastingly famous leader. He was one of the first to record, and many of his recordings are treasured collector's items today. From his Creole jazz band, we can get a good idea of the sound of classic New Orleans jazz, as played by two trumpets, trombone, clarinet, piano, bass, and drums. The young man seated in the center of this group is perhaps the most notable single figure in the entire history of jazz, Louis Armstrong. It is one of King Oliver's claims to fame that he gave young Armstrong his first important job in this band. But this is the very first band that Louis appeared in. At age 12, he spent some time in a reform school after a minor escapade, and it was here that he first learned to play the trumpet. Louis Armstrong was born in 1900 and grew up as jazz was growing up in New Orleans. Here he's seen with his mother and sister. At age 18, Armstrong was part of the band on a Mississippi riverboat, which served not only as an excursion steamer, but also as a basic means of transportation to the many cities up the river. The stern wheelers of the Streckfuss line, whose owner was a jazz fan, regularly employed New Orleans musicians. In the course of such jobs, they began to spread their music far beyond the limits of that one city. So far, in tracing the growth of early jazz from a variety of musical ancestors, we have concentrated on the work of Negro musicians. But in New Orleans, there was also a tradition of white parade bands that picked up many of the same musical trends. This photo shows Mardi Gras Day in 1903. The drummer in the right foreground is Papa Jack Lane, whose several bands combined ragtime with the new music of Buddy Bolden and his successors. Under Lane's influence, this group of young white jazz men developed a band that clearly borrowed from their black contemporaries. The original Dixieland jazz band soon moved north, became the rage of New York and then England, and in 1917 became the very first group to make a genuine jazz recording. In the 1910s and 20s, there were as yet no radio networks, and recording was in its infancy. But these primitive phonographs were making it possible for the first time to hear such music in your own home. Jazz musicians, aware that they had potential audiences elsewhere, began to leave New Orleans. Their exodus was hastened and eventually made permanent by a 1917 wartime measure, which closed the New Orleans honky-tonk district, making jobs for musicians far less plentiful. Travel often meant vaudeville stage appearances that were in sharp contrast to both honky-tonk and marching band settings. The man in the derby hat on stage in San Francisco in 1921 is none other than the great King Oliver. Most musicians who left New Orleans found their way to Chicago, the big city at the other end of the Mississippi River. This led to a remarkable paradox. The greatest flowering of New Orleans jazz took place in Chicago, and that flowering led to two decades of swift and kaleidoscopic changes in jazz, which we will examine in later sections of this history.